There's got to be an explanation to all these UFO sightings, right? Hey, it's Stephen Diener, host of the Unidentified Alien Podcast. And whether you're new to the conversation or have been looking into it for years, you need to check out the fastest growing alien show out there, the Unidentified Alien Podcast, or UAP for short. There's a crazy amount of alien encounter stories out there from all over the world. And the beauty of it is that I bring them all to you and let you decide what you believe. Download and subscribe to UAP on any of the major podcasting platforms. And you can also find it on UAPpodcast.com.
The Joyce Kaufman Podcast is being brought to you by Code Red Roofers, South Florida's leading residential and commercial roof experts. Code Red Roofers, roofers that respond. Call 844-4-CODE-RED or visit CodeRedRoofers.com.
Welcome to this edition of Joyce Kaufman's No Restraint Podcast. One thing I can tell you is, of late, the more I think about the way we understand our government, the less confident I am that we're going to have an election that's going to result in anything that would be good for this country. And what's really amazing to me right now is watching all these elitists, people who, I guess in some part I've been part of over the years, suddenly come to the realization that the government is not on their side. Not only is it not on their side, but the things that it is doing are definitely detrimental to all of us. You know, among the many great lines in T.S. Eliot's Four Quarters is this observation that the dry savages, which is the third in the bunch, we had the experience but missed the meaning. How much happens to us when we only half register or undergo without really twigging its significance? One example that is both pedestrian and historical is the criminal trial in Manhattan of Donald Trump. And Trump is leading in the polls, which means he's not only at the head of the chief opposition party, but also that he represents an existential threat to the future of the regime that is prosecuting him. The trial, which was brought by a George Soros-funded DA Alvin Bragg, is often described as being about hush money, the $130,000 that Trump allegedly paid to Stephanie Clifford, better known as Stormy Daniels, even better known as porn star Stormy Daniels, though there seems to be little that is Stormy about the litigant. In fact, there is nothing illegal about paying someone for a non-disclosure agreement. That is not an accurate description of this case to say that it's a hush money case, since the payment was delivered through Trump's former lawyer and Mr. Fix-It, Michael Cohen, who was reimbursed via a series of 34 payments. One wit described the reimbursement as Trump lying to his own checkbook, which, by the way, is also not a crime. But never doubt the ingenuity of bureaucrats armed with the tools of a weaponized Department of Justice. The Wall Street Journal had an excellent summary of the bizarre hermeneutical gymnastics that went into turning a possible minor misdemeanor into a 34-count felony charge. The spectacle is quite an experience, though I'm not sure its meaning is broadly grasped as yet. Nor is the meaning of the spectacle of Judge Juan Merchan, a vocal Biden supporter and donor, an equally vocal Trump detractor, really clear yet. He has threatened Trump with jail if he fails to be present for his trial and has even suggested that he will not allow Trump to attend the high school graduation of his son Barron or a hearing before the Supreme Court over the question of presidential immunity. Since the trial is in New York, Judge Merchan had a reliably anti-Trump jury pool to draw upon. It will be quite an experience, a circus of a trial with lots of histrionics, just as it was quite an experience to learn that clients of Judge Merchan's daughter, Lauren, a Democratic political consultant, had raised some $93 million in campaign donations off the case so far. Everyone, no matter his political coloration, agrees this criminal trial of Donald Trump is a watershed moment. At the moment, though, we're all in the chewing phase of the experience. It's all, can you believe it? Either celebration or outrage, depending. Only later when we move on to the anterior phases of digestion, will the meaning of this spectacle become clear. Eventually, and soon it will be borne in upon all of us. This is the way the Republic ends, not with a bang, but a perversion of the law.
Hi, everybody. This is Adriana Trigiani. I'm the host of You Are What You Read. I have the privilege of interviewing luminaries of our times about the books that shaped them from childhood until now. We get everybody from Sarah Jessica Parker to Kristen Hanna, Mitch Albom, Susie Essman, Craig Ferguson, Rainn Wilson, Amor Towles, you name it, they come, they share. New episodes of You Are What You Read drop every Tuesday on Apple, Spotify, or any major streaming platform wherever you listen to your podcasts.
Admiral Yamamoto of Japan is said to have opined that America could never be successfully invaded. A well-armed populace is indeed a bulwark against state tyranny. But Yamamoto neglected to consider the possibility that a weaponized one-party state could cow and intimidate the populace to such an extent that its tyranny became a matter of a carefully choreographed takeover of all the institutions. That would seem to be the real meaning of the experience we are even now undergoing. I heard an essay by Batya Unger Sargon, who happens to be a Newsweek editor, opinion editor, and she's got a new book out, which is called Second Class, How the Elites Betrayed America's Working Men and Women. And she said that on election night, many people who thought they knew who would be the next president of the United States were blindsided when Hillary Clinton lost to Donald Trump. Legacy media quickly scrambled to account for what had happened, and they ultimately arrived at an explanation that Trump's voters were racist, xenophobic conspiracy theorists, and possibly even proto-fascists. That wasn't quite right. And that's what Batya Unger Sargon talks about as she went on a journey for 8 years to understand how Trump won the White House in 2016 and how the left fundamentally misunderstood the American working class. She eventually came to the conclusion that the most salient feature of American life is not our political divide. It's the class divide that separates the college-educated from the working class. Democrats have historically been the party of the working class. But for the better part of the past decade, Democrats have seen their support among working-class voters tumble. Policy wonks and demographic experts keep saying, oh, just wait, the future of the Democratic Party is a multi-ethnic, multiracial, working-class coalition. But that didn't pan out. Instead, in 2016, Trump carried 54% of voters with family incomes of $30,000 to $50,000, 44% of voters with family incomes under $50,000, and nearly 40% of union workers voted for Trump, the highest for a Republican presidential candidate since Ronald Reagan in 1984. Meanwhile, in 2022, Democrats had a 15-point deficit among working-class voters, but a 14-point advantage among college-educated voters. In order to understand how and why this happened, Batya decided to spend a year traveling the country talking to working-class Americans. Who are they? Do they still have a fair shot at the American dream? What do they think about their chances to secure the hallmarks of a middle-class life? And she collected a bunch of these stories in her new book, Second Class, How the Elites Betrayed America's Working Men and Women. And what she found is that for many of them, the American dream felt dead. So I want you to think about that in the context of what I'm going to be speaking about. Really, it's how have we allowed the representation by academia, by government, and by the media, which is probably the most important player in all of this, how have we allowed them to not just tell us we're divided, but to hopelessly divide us? And it's easy to see why many people believe that politicians who relentlessly accuse the other side of undermining democracy and endangering the vulnerable while the legacy media, which no longer even pretends to be objective, consistently portrays its side's enemies in the worst of terms. People on the right are racist, says the left. People on the left are groomers, says the right, and so on and so forth. But what if I told you that the people in the political and media classes are the ones who are polarized? In fact, they're the only ones who are polarized. This is obvious to most Americans, even, perhaps especially, to those who have neighbors or friends or colleagues who vote differently than they do. Regular Americans know that we're more united than divided on the issues that are supposedly tearing us apart. Democrats portray conservatives as characters out of The Handmaid's Tale, and Republicans portray liberals as baby killers. Yet two-thirds of Americans agree that abortion should be rare and also legal. Democrats like to tell us that Republicans are gung-ho on school shootings, and Republicans are fond of saying Democrats want to steal your guns. Yet 61% of Americans believe that the Second Amendment should stand, but it's too easy to get a gun. Democrats tell us Republicans hate gays, and Republicans tell us that Democrats want every child to be queer. Yet average Americans believe that sex is determined at birth and that trans people should be protected from discrimination, though when it comes to sports, trans people should compete on teams that match the sex they were born with. This is how 6 in 10 of us feel. The partisan claims of a polarized America ring especially false to working-class Americans. This is because, unlike the college-educated elites who run the country, they don't identify with the full list of policy proposals produced by either party. When you interview working-class Americans across the country from every political persuasion, as Batya Unger Sargon did for her book, Second Class, what she found was a remarkable consensus on the issues. Everyone wants higher wages. They want better health care, or really, just affordable health care. They want fewer migrants competing for their jobs, and they want trade policy that favors America. They want stable jobs that reward their immense efforts with the hallmarks of a middle-class life, so that many in the top income brackets take for granted things like a home, a vacation with their kids every now and then, enough in the bank so they don't have to call the electric company every month to beg forbearance to keep the lights on, some money to put away for retirement for when their aching bones can no longer perform physical labor. Of course, the working class is not a monolith. A group of people as radically diverse as America's working class is bound to have a lot of diversity of opinion. And yet, when it comes to the questions of politics and policy, their opinions are a lot less diverse than you might think. An extreme moderation characterizes America's working class, coupled with the kind of deep tolerance and humility you can learn from a life of precarity. By and large, you'll meet a lot of people who say they would never get an abortion, but feel appalled by the idea of an abortion ban. Most people support something close to a moratorium on immigration, both legal and illegal, for the foreseeable future. They also support a government-backed health care plan, or even some support full governmental health care. They are very pro-gay. A lot of Christians who have gay people in their lives want to see them treated with respect, and they hope they'll find lasting love. But they are also very worried about transgender ideology, especially in schools. They support taxing corporations and the rich, but not expanding the welfare state, which they see as rewarding laziness. They all know someone who was scamming the welfare system while they worked and worked and worked and still struggled. And they felt frustration toward those who chose to live off the government teat, but also anger at corporations that maximized profit at the expense of their workers and politicians who didn't seem to care. These views were held by almost every working class person. whether they said they were conservative or liberal. Again, when polled, it's how most Americans feel. Nearly two-thirds say healthcare should be the federal government's responsibility. The same percent want to see the level of immigration decreased. Opinions about immigration change when Americans have a college degree. People who make under $100,000 a year are much less likely to support the mass migration we've been seeing than those making more than $100,000 a year. And yet, neither political party represents these positions that unify most Americans. The Democrats support taxing corporations and expanding health care, while also supporting the medical of teenagers, the expansion of the welfare state, and an open border policy that allows an unlimited supply of low-wage competition to enter the country. The Republicans want to restrict immigration and limit welfare, while also supporting corporations and lowering taxes on the rich. And its representatives never utter the words universal health care except as a slur. Who should the working class vote for? In the best-case scenario, they can pick one party that supports half their views but actively undermines the rest. At best, it's a crapshoot, which explains working-class people's frustration with both political parties. It also explains why working Americans aren't polarized like elites. Political and media elites tend to believe their party has chosen wisely on unrelated topics like immigration, climate change, and abortion. But working class people know that the stances each party has chosen are arbitrary. That is why they have tolerance for working class folk who vote for the other party. They know that the way they vote reflects only a portion of their political views and extremely little of their larger identities. You can't be devoted to a party that represents only half your views while actively undermining the other half. And you can't hate someone for choosing the other party when it's such a crapshoot. And that's where the data backs up Unger's observations. A 2019 study by James Druckmann and Matthew Lewandowski in Public Opinion Quarterly found that individuals were more animus toward the other party's elites than they do toward people who vote for the other party. And Anthony Fowler at the University of Chicago has found again and again that the majority of Americans do not consider themselves left or right, but moderate. So who represents them? No one. Progressives on the left, to demand that billionaires pay their fair share, are unwilling to share any of the prosperity that has come their way now that a college degree has become the new prerequisite of a middle-class life. Conservatives on the right demand that the working class, the GOP's new base, sacrifice their one vote on the altar of fighting wokeness, while elites in the party revert to the free market politics that have impoverished their voters. There is no party that represents the American dream, in which a life of hard work is rewarded by a home, a retirement, the occasional vacation, and a better life for one's kids. In other words, a life free from the precariousness that plagues the working class today. It's led to a working class electorate that feels alienated from both parties. They have only each other to rely on, and they found a home with Donald Trump. It's not hard to understand that, really, because he spoke to that frustration, and he expressed a desire to represent their best interests, not the interests of the Republican Party or the Democrat Party or academia or the media. Fake news, right? No, no. He spoke directly to the people, the working class people. And that is true today. So hold on to your hats, because I believe we're in for a very, very rocky ride with this upcoming election. The other subject that I wanted to talk about a little today was this whole idea that all of a sudden euthanasia is again, not just back in the news, but really just rearing its ugly head. And again, culture is defined by the lowest common denominator sometimes. There's a woman that was examined or actually interviewed who expects to be euthanized in early May. That's next month. Her plan, she said, is to be cremated. I didn't want to burden my partner with having to keep the grave tidy. We haven't picked an urn yet, but that will be my new house. She added an urn emoji to an email following the word house. Psychiatrists are saying that if there's nothing they can do to help you, maybe you're hobbled by depression or autism or borderline personality disorder, psychiatrists are now saying, well, it's never going to get any better. And if you think it would be better if you died, well, then we should make that possible. So imagine you have a person like this lady who was interviewed, who's got a tattoo on her arm, upper left arm, that says a tree of life, but it's in reverse. The tree of life stands for growth and new beginnings, but her tree is the opposite. It's losing its leaves and it's dying. And once the tree died, the bird flew out of it. I didn't see it as my soul leaving, but more as myself being freed from life. Her liberation, as it were, will take place at her home. No music. I will be going on the couch in the living room. She added, the doctor really takes her time. It's not like they walk in and say, lay down, please. Most of the time, it's first a cup of coffee to settle the nerves and create a soft atmosphere. Then they ask if you're ready. You take your place on the couch. They ask again, are you sure? And then they start up the procedure and wish you a good journey or a nice nap, because a lot of people say safe journey, but I'm not really going anywhere. Then the doctor will administer a sedative followed by a drug that will stop the heart. And when you're dead, a euthanasia review committee will evaluate your death to ensure the doctor adhered to due care criteria. And in Holland, where this particular case took place, the Dutch government will declare that the life of the lady was lawfully ended. She's asked her boyfriend to be with her to the very end. There won't be any funeral. She doesn't have much family. She doesn't think her friends will feel like going. Instead, her boyfriend will scatter her ashes in a nice spot in the woods that they have chosen together. I'm a little afraid of dying because it's the ultimate unknown, she said. We don't really know what's next, or is there nothing? That's the scary part. She's one of a growing number of people across Western civilization choosing to end their lives rather than live in pain, pain that in many cases can be treated. Typically, when we think of people who are considering assisted suicide, we think of people facing terminal illness. But this new group is suffering from other syndromes, depression or anxiety exacerbated, they say, by economic uncertainty or the climate or social media and a seemingly limitless array of fears and disappointments. I'm seeing euthanasia as some sort of acceptable option brought to the table by physicians, by psychiatrists, when previously it was the ultimate last resort, said a healthcare ethicist at a theological university in the Netherlands. I see the phenomenon, especially in people with psychiatric diseases, and especially young people with psychiatric disorders, where the healthcare profession seems to have given up on them more easily than before. A healthcare ethics professor at Protestant Theological University served for a decade on a euthanasia review board in the Netherlands. I entered the review committee in 2005, and I was there until 2014. In those years, I saw the Dutch euthanasia practice evolve from death being a last resort to death being a default option. He ultimately resigned. A lot of people across the West are choosing to end their lives rather than live in pain, even psychological pain. And then there are people who, critics argue, have been tacitly encouraged to kill themselves by laws that destigmatize suicide, a social media culture that glamorizes it, and a radical right-to-die activist who insists we should be free to kill ourselves whenever our lives are complete, whatever that means. They have fallen victim to a kind of suicide contagion. Statistics suggest that the critics have a point. In 2001, the Netherlands became the first country in the world to make euthanasia legal. Since then, the number of people who increasingly choose to die is startling. In 2022, the most recent year for which there is data, Dutch officials recorded 8,720 cases of euthanasia. That's a 13.5% increase from the year before, when there were 7,666 cases. To put this in perspective, there were a total of 170,000 deaths in the Netherlands in 2022, meaning euthanasia cases comprised more than 5%. This upward trend in both the absolute and relative numbers has been visible for a number of years, and it's not just the Netherlands. Now, Dutch law is being examined by many here in the West, in the United States, in Great Britain, and especially in Canada. You see, when it's time to end your life and commit suicide, according to those who endorse the euthanasia movement, it's much better than a lonely suicide to offer euthanasia. So we've normalized it. Medical assistance in dying programs are called MAID, which legalized assisted suicide for those whose deaths were reasonably foreseeable. When Prime Minister Justin Trudeau introduced this legislation, he said his government was focused very much on respecting Canadian rights and defending their choices. In 2017, the first full year in which it was in effect, almost 3,000 people chose to die by assisted suicide. By 2021, that figure had jumped to 10,000, accounting for more than 3% of all deaths in Canada. In 2022, it was 13,241. By early 2023, 61% of Canadians support the idea of euthanasia, although they oppose expanding it. Coming soon to a neighborhood near you. I don't know about the rest of you, but I think life is precious. I stand up for the unborn. I'm certainly going to stand up for the born. Do I believe that there may be instances where there is no other solution but to end a life? Yes, I do. But I also believe that once the government gets involved, we're going to be up you-know-what creek without a paddle. Thank you for listening to today's No Restraint podcast. I hope you will share it with a friend, and I hope you will be listening to the next one. In the meantime, may God bless you, may God bless Israel, and may God bless the United States of America.
The Joyce Kaufman Podcast has been brought to you by Code Red Roofers, South Florida's leading residential and commercial roof experts. Code Red Roofers, roofers that respond. Call 844-4-CODE-RED or visit CodeRedRoofers.com.